We learned last week about how Titus entered and blasphemed and pierced the paroches with his sword, and blood came trickling from the paroches. Now the Gemara tells us that Titus took the paroches and made it like this huge sack and put inside all the vessels of the temple, which is obviously an exaggeration. You can't fit all the vessels of the temple in the paroches. And he took them like that in the sack to bring them back to Rome. And the idea was he wanted to show the people in Rome how the paroches had bled, which in his mind showed that he had killed the God of the Jews. Now he's taking it back to Rome, and the Gemara quotes the pasuk, "Uvechin ra'iti resha'im." King Solomon said in Ecclesiastes, "I've seen wicked kivurim; they are buried vavau, and they're coming. U'mimkom kadoshi aleichu; they come from a holy place. That's Titus; he's coming from the Temple Mount. Ve'ishtakhu ve'ir asher kenasun; they'll be forgotten in the city that they've done so." So ultimately, even the wicked that do horrendous acts, they're buried and forgotten. And the Gemara says, "Al tikri kvurim ela kibutzim." We make a drasha in the pasuk that we look at the wicked who have gathered in the holy place to destroy it, and they've come back to their city. Don't read it as v'yishtakhu, to be forgotten, but rather v'yishtabchu, they take pride. So Titus is coming back with his whole army to take pride in Rome. Look at how I destroyed the temple. And this is one, Rashi says, the continuation of the verse, gamzeh haven. This too is something that seems worthless. Why did God create the world so that the wicked work so hard, and then they want to take pride, and ultimately after all that work, it's forgotten? But that's only ultimately. Initially, they seem to have succeeded. You look initially at Titus, he destroyed Jerusalem, he destroyed the Temple Mount. And the people in that generation, what did they see? They saw Titus as successful. The Rishonim seemed to succeed. Shlomo HaMelech says, be long-sighted, be long-winded. Ultimately, he's going to be forgotten. Why did God create the world so? So this goes back to the basic understanding as to why we really have a hard time seeing God in the world. God created the world in a way that we have free will. If you have free will, then it's not going to be overtly obvious that God is running the show. And that means that the wicked are going to get away with what they do, at least on the surface. If things were so obvious that when someone does something wrong, bam, he gets punished, then it would be easier to be good. The test of this world is that you look at the world, it's very easy to think God's not running the show. The wicked certainly seem to be succeeding. And that's the test of being a good person in this world. In Judaism we say that's the test of being a good person and believing that God really runs the world. But if you want to look at it even irreligiously, that's the test of being a good person. Because when you look at the world and you see, hey, wait a second. When I keep Shabbos, when I'm a good person, I pay my taxes. I don't cheat on my taxes. And I end up with less money in the bank. The guy next door to me, he cheats on his taxes. He's open on Shabbos and he has more money in the bank. So on the surface, it seems like, hey, it pays to be bad. It pays not to keep Shabbos. It pays to do things that are wrong. And on the surface, that's what it's going to look like. That's the way God created the world. Yeah?
Question. I'm going to ask myself, do bad people have more fun?
Do bad people have more fun? On the surface, bad people have more fun. Now, it's going to depend on how you define fun. Meaning, we live in a world that's focused on the here and now. So, part of that focus means that people want high-speed internet. And now it's not enough to have high-speed internet. At every given moment, I have to know what's going on that internet. So, it's not enough that I have internet at home. I have to have it on my laptop. It's not enough that I have it on my laptop. I have to have it on my Palm Pilot. It's not enough that I have it on my Palm Pilot. I have to have it on my BlackBerry so I could email, so I could send back and forth. So there can't go by a second where I don't know what's going on. Instantaneous gratification. But where does it lead to? It leads to a tremendous need for psychiatrists and psychologists in a world that is devoid of true pleasure. People are unhappy with their marriages because in marriage, you cannot have it here and now fun. It won't be. It won't be. And if you open up the TV or the internet, you'll see there are glamorous girls that are all smiles, and they'll be happy for you to do whatever you want with them. And then you think, gee, why should I be in marriage? We have to invest. And I could go out there and have a one-night stand and have the time of my life. It's very tempting, and it's even more tempting for a person who's chozer b'tshuva because he comes from a world where that's the norm. But if you look at that world up close, you'll see that really people aren't having such a good time. People are spending their time looking for thrills, so they're constantly seeking pleasure. But true pleasure is something that comes from investment. True pleasure is what one has from a marriage after years of investment. It's not something you could get from a short relationship. True friendship. Anything that's worthwhile requires investment. Judaism constantly trains us to invest in the long term. And that investment in the long term will reap greater rewards. In the short term, it feels like I'll enjoy now. Let's take a small example. A person gets his paycheck. So now he has 5,000 shekel in the bank. What's he going to do with it? So most people are going to say, I have 5,000 shekel. Let me go on vacation. It's the summer. I have 5,000 shekel. Let me go buy some ice cream. I can afford it. I work hard. This is what I worked for. So he goes out and he buys an ice cream cone for 8 shekel and he goes on vacation for 500 shekel and he rents a car to drive up north. And okay, before long, after 3-4 days living like this, he says, if I'm going on vacation, I might as well enjoy the vacation. So on vacation he splurges and he buys all the expensive things they sell in all these places. And he wants to have a souvenir to remember all the good time he had. But when he gets back home, he still has to pay rent and he still has to pay everything else he has to pay. And he's not left with the money to pay it. If a person were more intelligent, then a person would stop and say, wait a second, in the long term, life is going to be much better if I buy a house and I stop paying rent. I'd rather pay a mortgage, pay off a house, and ultimately I'll have my own home. So that person is going to take his paycheck and say, okay, let me take off this much so I could save it for buying a house. Let me take off this much so I could save money to marry off my children in the future. When you look at the surface, who's having a better time? The guy who's going on vacation, the guy who's buying the ice cream bars. I mean, this is the story of the piggies, right? This little piggy built a house of straw. This little piggy built a house of sticks. This little piggy built a house of cement. You guys never learned this? Come on. You don't need Judaism for this. This is the concept from the three little pigs. The ones who built their house of sticks and straws, well, they had much more time to play. I play all day, right? How's the song go? I built my house of sticks. I built my house of twigs. With a hay builder, life, with my fiddle, I build my house of sticks. Now I have all time to play. I'm going to play all day. With a hay did a little, right? Okay. So we all grew up on the three little pigs. Well, that's the message of the three little pigs. And in a nutshell, that encapsulizes the idea that really is one of the main ideas in Mishle, as Rav Saadia Gaon writes in his introduction to Mishle, that we really have two things driving us. There's the physical that's always driving us for the short term, for the here and now. And then there are the things that are more spiritual, that understand, that are more seichelik, that make more sense, that tell us, okay, invest in the long term. Marriage is an investment in the long term. Short term, it's not the best investment. It takes a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of investment, a lot of questions. And what?
A lot of stress.
A lot of stress, right? But in the long term, you build your life. The question, do the evil have more pleasure? So I think on the surface, in the short term, they have more pleasure. I think beyond the surface, even in the short term, they don't have more pleasure. Because the guy who eats the ice cream bar, that level of pleasure is on a very surface. Even a person that's not investing in a long-term relationship but is interested in short-term relationships, he's never going to get the depth of pleasure that someone who builds a relationship gets. You know what it means to have someone that you can walk into the house and they just look at your face and they know what kind of day you had? You say one thing and they know you meant something else? I was once sitting at a table when a wife asked her husband what he wants for lunch. So he says, soup. And she brings him out noodles. So he didn't even notice. He's eating. And I'm thinking, boy, what code do they talk in? He said, soup, she brings noodles. Okay. At some point during the meal, so he said, oh, these are delicious noodles. So she said, yeah, I thought you'd like it. And then it dawned on him that he asked for soup and she brought out noodles. So he asked her what happened. So she said, oh, it's the first time you noticed? She said, you mean you've done this before? So she says, well, I know that when you come in at home in the afternoon in the summer and it's hot, Even if you see me serving soup to the other kids and you tell me you want soup, if I serve you soup, you're not happy. It warms you up and then you're even hotter and then you're tired and then you can't learn. So I knew you'd prefer the noodles, so I brought you out noodles. So he said soup, she brought noodles. She knew what he wanted better than he knew. In life, when you build a relationship, you're building something. That's a small example. What's the difference if you eat soup or noodles? But that shows you when someone cares for someone and they understand what someone really wants and what's really good for someone else, it's a totally different relationship. The idea that when you have a day and you know you're going to come home and have someone to share that day with, someone who's as interested as you are in what happened to you today and as interested as you are in figuring out what's good, and someone who's investing in the home, investing in the children, you come home and you're interested in what they've been doing. I'm not talking about going through the class here and beyond the bite and then coming home and saying, oh, I learned that I'm supposed to ask you how you're doing. I told you guys this story. The guy writes his wife a note, and his wife says, that's such a beautiful note, and he says, Rav Frankenthal told me to write it. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about that it's real, that you come home and you really care how was your day. That's something which takes long-term investment. And the same is true for all forms of real pleasure. And it's not a Jewish concept. I mean, the Torah trains us and teaches us how to do it. But this isn't only in the Torah. This is this is common knowledge. Anyone out there will tell you that. Anyone that's experienced it for real. So it takes investment, it takes time. And the truth is that even at the moment that you're investing, let's take a sharp example for our wonderful chatanim here, which we're 50-50 in this class. No, it's not true. You guys are outnumbered. I'm not a chatan either. When it does happen, and in every home it happens, that there are arguments, and they can really hurt internally. And Ephraim said, there's stress. So there are moments when a person feels like, this ain't worth it. Now, a person has a choice at that moment. He could talk out that thought and ruin a lot. Or a person can swallow it and feel terrible. The Mefarshim say, the Medrash says, one of the hardest things is to be quiet. But during those moments that a person is quiet, what he feels on the surface, if we're going to compare the surface level pleasure of the guy eating the ice cream, driving his Mercedes, touring the world, and seemingly enjoying everything life has to offer, on that same surface level, the other guy is eating himself up alive. This is what I got married for. He's clenching his teeth. But let's go beyond the surface. Deep down inside, the guy who's eating the ice cream feels like, is this what life is all about? This isn't what I really want it to be. The Pasuk says, Tov marei einayim me'alach nafesh. The eyes, what they think they see, the pleasure we anticipate is always greater than the pleasure that's really there. When we're looking at physical and external pleasures, Tov marei einayim, what the eyes see is better me'alach nafesh than when the soul walks through it all. When we really experience it, it's never as good as we really thought it would be. The guy who's eating the ice cream bar on the surface is enjoying. You ask him, are you having a good time? Yeah, this is life. Beyond the surface, it's a different story. There's a certain emptiness. We have a neshama that's always striving for something of value, and that neshama senses when we're trying to placate it with the externals. By the same token, the other guy, on the surface, he's suffering. You talk to him, he'll tell you, this is the most bitter moment of my life. I never thought life would be so rough. And oh, he's got a million words to say. But beyond the surface, what's going on? The neshama is having satisfaction. It's interesting. This is a concept that's very hard for us to connect with. That Rabbi Akiva could stand there and they're peeling the flesh off of him and he's saying, my whole life I've been living for this moment. We have a hard time connecting beyond the surface. To us, the surface is what's most existent. If right now I'm suffering in the heat, that's what I sense most. If right now I have a toothache, that's what I sense most. My focus is on the surface. It takes a great person to be able to really recognize what's beyond the surface. And with time, it comes to the surface as well. When a person has children, when a person has a home, when a person reaps the benefits, like the guy who didn't go and spend his paycheck, but saved it in order to invest long term and make sure that in the long term things are going to be good. So eventually in the long term it does come to the surface. So I think the answer is, on the surface it's definitely more pleasurable to do what's wrong, and the surface pleasure is for sure more instantaneous and seems more common when you do what's wrong. And beyond the surface, I think many people won't sense it, so they won't agree with me, but I think beyond the surface, even in the here and now, it's more pleasurable to do what's right. But that you can argue with. That's not something I could point to. But in the long term, so then the facts speak for themselves. So Titus has said, Titus thinks I conquered God. And now he takes all the vessels from the temple and he's taking them out to Rome. And when they're at sea, so the waves start pounding against the ship, and Titus recognizes he hasn't killed the God of the Jews. And Titus says, must be the strength of the God of the Jews is only in the waters. He defeated Paro and the Egyptians in the Yamsuf. Sisera, the general of Canaan, and his soldiers were wiped out in the waters of the Kishon Valley. And now he wants to destroy me with the waters. If he's really a great warrior, let him come with me to the dry land and fight me there. And a heavenly voice came out and said, Rasha, the son of Arasha, grandson of Esav of Arasha. I have a light creature in this world, Briakala, a light creature. It's called a Yetush. That's a fly that can only consume. It can't excrete. It's a light creature, a little Yetush. You come on dry land and fight my light creature called a Yetush. And you'll notice this is the way God often works. When we try to challenge God, God doesn't come down to our level. We have a concept in Gemara that's called treat the mitzvos with respect. Shelo yiyu mitzvot bezuyot alecha. We have mitzvah of kisei adam. After you slaughter an animal, you're supposed to cover the blood, right? If it's a wild animal or a bird, you're supposed to cover the blood. So the Torah tells us, cover it in a respectful way. You could shove over a little bit of dirt with your foot. Says the Torah, no, scoop up some dirt and pour the dirt on it. When you perform a mitzvah, perform it in a respectful way. Why? So we would say, so you don't disgrace the mitzvah. The Gemara doesn't say that. The Gemara says, Shelo yiyu mitzvot bezuyot alecha. The mitzvah shouldn't be disgraceful by you. If you do something like that, you didn't disgrace the mitzvah. The mitzvah is still the precious pearl that it always was. But by you, you've disgraced yourself in the way you treated the mitzvah. The mitzvah shouldn't be disgraceful in your eyes. But at the same token, Titus challenges God. Take me up on dry land, I'll take you on. God says, I'll take you on? Oh, no, I'll send the little fly I have called a Yetush. That's the lightest creature I have. You take him on and let's see you conquer him. You'll see that he could conquer you.
Lice.
What?
Lice.
Yetush is probably mosquito, more like a mosquito. Lice. Yeah. So, they come on dry land and God sends a Yetush in through his nostril or through his ear and it enters his skull. And it spends 7 years eating away at his brain. And he's suffering. He has tremendous headaches. Something's eating away at his brain. And one day he walks by a blacksmith. And when he hears the blacksmith banging on the anvil, so this mosquito gets scared and it stops. So he says, oh, I found a cure. So he hires blacksmiths day and night. He's living with people pounding next to his head to keep the mosquito quiet. So he's forgone the pounding of the mosquito. He doesn't know what's going on in his mind. For the pounding of the blacksmith. And when he'd hire a non-Jewish blacksmith, he'd pay him 4 zuz, but around the clock, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you can't always find blacksmiths. Where are you going to find the blacksmith at 2 o'clock in the morning? Eventually they tire out, so he had to hire Jewish blacksmiths as well. And when he'd hire a Jewish blacksmith to pound next to him, he'd tell him, I'm not paying you. Your payment is enough that you see your enemy like me. I'm your arch enemy. You see me suffering. And our sages say that part of the idea here was that Titus would have to be in this position where he needs a Jewish blacksmith before him and he needs to show the Jews that he's subservient to God. So that was part of his punishment, that he needed to hire a Jewish blacksmith. After 30 days, the mosquito got used to it, and it didn't help the pounding of the blacksmith. And Rabbi Pinchas ben Arova says, I was one of the nobles of Rome, and when Titus died, so they broke open his skull to see what it was that was pounding at his head, and they found that the mosquito had grown to the size of a bird. It's huge, this mosquito. It had eaten away at his brain. Now, Titus was wicked not only in his life, but even post-mortem. The Gemara tells us that Unculus, the son of Colonicus, he was his nephew, he wanted to become Jewish, he wanted to become a ger. So he raised Titus from the dead with an oath, and he asked him, who's important in the world to come? Now that you're deceased, you see the world of truth, who's important over there? So Titus said, the Jewish people. So Uncle said, what do you say, I attach myself with them? So he said, Titus doesn't answer him directly, he can't lie, but he tells him true answers to try and dissuade him. We see that even in the world to come, his nefesh was defiled. He says, they have many mitzvos, and you won't stand up to all the mitzvos. Now this is a very important point. Titus knew the weak point of every ger. When you become a ger, it's a new way of life. Suddenly Shabbos. Whoever heard of such a thing? Suddenly I can't turn on a light, I can't turn off a light, I can't go into a car. Kashrus, I have to start thinking about, does it have a kosher certification? I can't eat wherever I want to go. Come on, this isn't easy. It's beautiful. Yeah, you look outside, you see a Jewish family, it's very nice. You start living it. Oh, Titus knew exactly where to hit him. Titus told him there are many mitzvos. You know, when it boils down to it, you think about it. Everything you do, the Torah tells you what to do. I wear clothing, tells me it can't be shatnez. I wear clothing, tells me it has to be modest. I go out into the marketplace, they tell me when I'm allowed to go out, when I'm not allowed to go out. On Shabbos, I'm not allowed to carry. I'm not allowed to carry my mukta things. It ain't easy. So Titus tells him, many mitzvos. And you should know that sometimes in life, this is the point I always tell Hasanim also, when you say a sentence, you're not only hurting the person in the here and now. You're hurting them very, very long term. A guy once came to me and said, my parents don't like the girl I'm dating. I want to get married to her. What do you say? So I said, I have nothing to say, but I'll tell you a few things to think about. One thing to think about is that your parents said many things against this girl. And whether you like it or not, you heard those things. Today, you're all excited. You want to marry her. And today, you tell your parents, leave it. I know what I'm doing. She's the right girl. 2 years down the road, things are going to be the way things normally are, and there are going to be issues to contend with. And then, when you have it all out, so you're going to walk into your room and you're going to think to yourself, my mother was right. She's stubborn. My mother was right. She doesn't understand me. The fact that your parents said all the negative things means that there's something in your mind sitting there, and it always has the potential to lurk up and haunt you. By the same token, when Titus tells him this, his uncle tells him, don't join the Jews, too many mitzvahs, it's going to be way too tough. He's not only hurting Uncleus at that moment by telling him, don't do it. He's also planting the seed so that long term, every time things are tough, and they are tough, Titus is going to think back, my uncle told me I shouldn't do it. Chazal tell us that Uncleus, the great Uncleus, you know how great Uncleus was. He wrote the commentary, the whole heaven and earth were floating. Titus wrote the Targum on Torah. Titus, we have a mitzvah, Uncleus, I'm sorry. We have a mitzvah every Shabbos to read Uncleus' translation of the Torah. Pretty great person, right? And yet Chazal tell us that as a ger, when he learned the Torah, so he reached a point where God says, I love the ger, I give him bread and clothing. So Titus went to the rabbis and said, that's all I get? God says he loves me, that's all he's giving me? Bread and clothing? So the rabbis explained to him, they said, no, bread is the lechem upon him, clothing are the clothing of the Kohen Gadol, you have the potential that your offsprings are going to be the greatest Jews of the Jewish people. Says the Medrash, they saved Uncleus from leaving Judaism. That's what the Medrash says. Even a great man like Uncleus reached a point where he felt like, this is really tough being ger, and if I have no potential beyond getting bread and clothing, I'm done. I can't handle this. And by giving him the word of encouragement at the right moment, they saved him. Even Uncleus. So his uncle tells him it's tough. So what does Titus tell him? Go challenge them. Go afflict them. Because God decreed, Hayutzara Lerosh, whoever comes to afflict the Jewish people becomes a great person. You want to become great? Afflict them. If you attack them, you'll become great. Here there are a few explanations as to why God created the world in such a way. Tosus explains that this is an issue of honor. That God says, I don't want my children to be destroyed by a low nation. They shouldn't be disgraced. So God says, at least the one who destroys them should be a great person. Rav Yonson Eibshitz explains that even though we all have free choice, the leaders of nations do not have free choice. So God wants to ensure that whoever is afflicting us won't do it beyond what he's supposed to. So God first makes him great and then controls him to ensure it isn't beyond what we really deserve. There's one more understanding, we'll conclude with this, that whoever afflicts the Jewish people ultimately causes them to repent. So that's why God says, I don't want this person to get merits, and the world to come will come to me and say, hey, I did them a big favor, I caused them to repent. So God says, I'll give you your wages in this world. And God makes him great. God makes him into a great empire. And that way he's gotten, so to speak, paid back for whatever good came from his actions.